Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Michael Donnelly. I'm an alcoholic. And before I begin, I want to thank Dick and Barbara for having us out. Why don't we give them a round of applause just for this weekend? It's just a great time. Wonderful. Thank you. The speakers so far have been absolutely outstanding. I mean, what a weekend. Just incredible, right? All the volunteers, the people who put all this together, the people at the registration. And I want to acknowledge Lee and his friends in the back there. You know that? They have not, yeah, for sure, right? Absolutely. You know, Bob mentioned Chuck C. yesterday. And, you know, we've talked about Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob all through this weekend, big book studies, all these different things, you know, and it's the ministry of these tapers that allow us to be able to experience these giants that came before us, and to be able to try to apply their principles into our lives. And without them, we'd have to go by word of mouth, and we tend to lean a little bit on the larceny side and the lion side, so who knows what we'd end up with today if it wasn't for those folks. So really appreciate them for sure. Also want to thank my beautiful bride, Marcia, for being here tonight, sticking with me for 20 years of marriage. That's a miracle in and of itself, and very grateful for that. Very grateful for that. My job is to share a little bit of my experience with steps 8 and 9, and two steps that I fully believe are absolutely where life begins to change for me. At least it did it in my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I crash-landed in AA when I was 24 years old. I had no idea what to expect. I really didn't have any idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I knew I was broken, but I didn't have any idea how bad, and I didn't know why. And as far back as I can remember, I mean, I come from a wonderful home. My mom and my dad were very, very good people, very good people. But I felt different than almost anybody I perceived felt. Whether they felt that way or not, I don't know. All I know is when I would compare myself to them, they always looked happier. They always looked more grounded. They always looked more at ease. They always looked more comfortable. And I didn't. I never felt that way. Way before I ever took a drink. And when I was 12 years old, I was sitting in a baseball field. My dad had passed away when I was 6. My mom had tried to raise my sister and I, sacrificed a ton so that we could stay out of the Chicago public school system in Chicago. I'm a chronic misdemeanor guy, but if I had gone to the public school system, I'm sure I'd be a chronic felon. I don't think there's any question about that. And I'm sitting in this baseball diamond, and this guy comes up to us, and he was one of the coolest-looking guys I had ever seen in my entire life. He had hair to his mid-back. He had a bandana on with a roach clip and one of those peacock feathers that you win at a carnival hanging off the back of it, right? And he says something like, do you guys get high? And we had no idea what to say. And we just kind of looked at him. I was 12 or 13 years old, and he was probably 17 or 18. And he reaches in his pocket, and he pulled out this weird-looking cigarette and a lighter and threw it in my buddy's lap and started going around in a circle. And we had stolen enough cigarettes from our parents where we knew how to smoke. We had never smoked that, but I remember hearing stories about how different smoking cigarettes and smoking pot was. And first difference was that when you smoke a cigarette, you hold it like this, but when you smoke a joint, apparently you hold it like this. Huge difference. I think we can all agree there. And then the other thing is that when you're smoking cigarettes, you exhale right away, but when you're smoking pot, you're supposed to hold it in, and the worst thing you can do is choke on your dope smoke. That would be the biggest loser move in the history of the South Side of Chicago. So this thing's coming around, and I'm just concentrating on this, and I grabbed this thing, and I took a couple of hits on it. I passed it on to a guy who almost looked like Johnny. And nothing happened. Nothing happened at all. I truly don't know if I even smoked marijuana that day. Could, for all I know, some 17-year-old rolled up oregano and gave it to a bunch of 12-year-olds. And I mean, I had no idea. And I got to tell you, for the next, 4 or 5 hours, I thought, they're making a really big deal out of this. They're making a big deal out of nothing, because nothing happened. It was tough to be cool. We stole cigarettes from our parents, right? My mom smoked Vantage 100s. Which are not the cool. If you're trying to be tough on the South Side of Chicago, Vantage 100s should not be your cigarette of choice. They're huge things. You need someone else to light it for you. You know, it's a bad deal. Turn quickly, burn someone in the temple. It's a bad deal. And And so literally the next day I'm walking down an alley in Chicago, and I see my buddy Timmy. And Timmy was a couple of years older than me, and he did exactly the same thing that the 17-year-old did, except when we smoked whatever it was Timmy gave me. It was a very different experience. Very different experience. And for the next several years, if you could light it on fire, I was smoking it. When I was about 16 years old, I just quit doing drugs. Drugs, for some reason, for me at least, are on this list of things that I have used to distract me from looking at me. And drugs never did for me what alcohol always did for me. They just never did. And by the time I was 16, we had a couple of differences that happened in our life. I got a little older. My friends had some cars. We got some wheels, and we could drive around the south side of Chicago, some of the suburbs, and we could get booze. It was a little difficult to do when you're 12 or 13 or 14 years old, but it was pretty easy to do when you're 16. And I got to tell you, I was always the kid that just, I always had the mouth, right? I was always the kid that said something, you know, inappropriate to the cheerleader whose football boyfriend was on the other side of the room. I was passed out in the back seat of cars. You know, they dumped me out on the lawn. I mean, this was just, from the beginnings of my drinking, I just drank differently than my friends. I just did. It did something to me that I never found really anything outside of the miracle of these 12 steps ever did for me. In many ways, when I look back on it now, I would say that alcohol was the great imposter. That what I was looking for was what this 12-step program promises me, which is a spiritual awakening, and that alcohol somehow impersonated that for me. It somehow simulated the sense of ease and comfort that we get from having a moment-to-moment relationship with God. Alcohol impersonated that for me. It gave me this every time I drank. It just did. And by the time I was 21 or 22 years old, I had gone to treatment, put myself in there for 36 hours. I was really going to give it the full effort. And just didn't land, didn't work out very well. By the time I was 24 years old, I was wanting to kill myself. I'm zipping through this story pretty quickly because I really want to talk about these steps. But it's important that you know where I come from. It's important that you know that I have this threefold malady, this threefold disease called alcoholism. And I met a guy named Brian. And Brian was a member of the Lamont Oaks group of Alcoholics Anonymous on the south side of Chicago. And more than just a meeting attender, Brian was, like many of those members over there, a 12-step working member of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I come to believe is very different. And then just a guy who goes to meetings. And Brian did something for me that day in the hallway, and I had known Brian for a long time. And Brian asked me this question, truthfully, that I've been asked many, many times in my life, and it was a very simple question. It was this: Mike, are you okay? And I truly don't know why I answered him differently this day than I, because I've been asked that question my whole life. My whole life I've been asked that question. And on that day I said something different. I said, no, I'm not okay. And he asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting, and I lied and said yes. And we went to this meeting, and there's a gentleman there who does a newcomers meeting before the regularly scheduled AA meeting. And I kind of wandered in there and sat down and listened to him go off for an hour or so, and I left. I never stayed for the regular meeting. And 6 weeks later, my life was horrible. It was just horrible. It was a drunken mess. And everything that I had come to appreciate in life and like in life and love in life all was slipping through my fingers. I could just feel it all going away. My family didn't really want much to do with me. I didn't have very much I certainly didn't have their respect at all. I had a fiance who was, anybody ever been engaged to eventually be divorced? Like before you, like while you're getting the ring, you're like, don't do it, it's not going to work. And then you buy it anyways. Like that's me, right? Everything was just falling apart around me. And on August 27th of 1991, I went back to that group. And I haven't had a drink since because they introduced me to something. When I was at that first meeting, when I stayed for that meeting, Brian, that same guy, gave me a big book. And he said, if you work this and you do this, your life will change. And if you don't work this and do this, your life will probably be the same whether or not you drink again. And I truthfully didn't know what he was talking about. But he was right. He was 100% right. And so I start going to these meetings. I'm just going to a lot of meetings. And I keep banging into certain people that are talking about the book and the steps. And then I'm banging into some people that are just started talking about different things. But slowly, over time, I began to connect with what you were saying. And I really began to feel like I was one of you, that I was part of you, that I had this thing that we call alcoholism, even though I didn't really know what it was. Shortly thereafter, I got transferred And so I'm only a few months sober, and I get this job transfer, and I move to South Dakota, and I meet this guy in these meetings, and he talked a lot like Brian talked. And so that was somehow attractive to me, although we had nothing in common. His name was Joe Friday, and Joe became my first sponsor. That is a great name for an AA sponsor, Joe Friday. And Joe was on his second marriage, or excuse me, his first marriage, but his wife, Loretta, was married to a gentleman before that. His name was Dick Tracy. I'm not kidding. Not kidding. It's a true story. So I said, Joe, will you sponsor me? And Joe said, I don't know. So we went to this place called the Crackpot, how ironic, and sat there and had some coffee and chain smoked. And he said, here's the deal. You tell me, I'll tell you my story, you tell me your story, and if at the end we think we can work together, I'll do it. And Joe went on and told me a story. And truthfully, I only heard maybe 20% of it because I was writing my own as he was talking. And I kind of got 10, 15 minutes into that story, and he kind of cut me off, and he said, kid, you have no idea what alcoholism is, do you? And I go, oh, yeah, it's when you drink a lot, right? I mean, I have all the evidence. I have the urine-stained Levi's. I have the puke on the shoulder. I have the bills. I have the legal problems. I have all this. I have all of it. He said, no, that's not alcoholism. That's drunkenness. Big difference between alcoholism and drunkenness. And I said, I don't know what you mean. And we slowly started to go through the book, and we went through doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth's brilliant, brilliant letters. And Joe began to explain to me this idea that I, perhaps if I had what he had, would have this physical malady, this, for some reason, some allergic reaction to alcohol. And he went on to explain that I could only understand what abnormal reaction to alcohol meant if I understood what a normal reaction to alcohol meant. And he described that to me. And I did not have a normal reaction to alcohol. You know, Joe went on to explain that people who have a normal reaction to alcohol generally stop drinking once they start. That once they begin to feel it, and I know this might sound weird to some of us, they quit, right? For me, that was when I felt the compulsion to put the pedal down, to go that extra mile for the sake of alcohol. Alcohol did something to me that, I gotta be honest with you, I certainly love being drunk. Don't misunderstand me, right? But I like that 3 to 4 beer buzz, or maybe like 2 beers and a shot buzz, where like everything's going to be great, you know? Like the financial thing's going to get worked out. She's coming home. I know it. I know she's coming home. It's going to be okay, right? They're not going to leave. The boss is going to promote. I'll figure out how to sell that guy. I got all the answers, 3 to 4, 3 to 5 drinks into this evening, right? I can walk in with all the problems in the entire world, and somewhere between 3 and 5, I got solutions for all of them. It's going to be okay. If I could live there, if I could have just stayed right there, I wouldn't be with you. I would not be with you. Right? But I couldn't. I never could. I never could. So Joe went on to explain that the inability to quit drinking once I start, this compulsion to continue on, was the manifestation of this thing that we call alcoholism, at least in terms of the physical realm. And that if I had what he had, I probably had the second part too, and that was this mind that lies to me, that it tells me stories, it fabricates to me, and I simply believe it. That the wolves in my life come to me as sheep's clothing. Alcohol never said to me, Mike, if you drink tonight, you're going to hurt people you really love. Never said that once. It never said, Mike, if you drink tonight, the police are showing up. Mike, if you drink tonight, you'll have more legal bills. Mike, if you drink... Never told me that. My mind talked me into the first drink by things like this. What, are you never going to go out again? Really? No friend? And that's what you're going to do? What kind of social life is a 24-year-old going to have if you never go out again? You know what? Go out and have one or two. And I went, okay. Go out, you know what, just bring $20. Don't bring $50, just bring $20. Don't drive. Have somebody else drive, right? I mean, I had so many things that came to me sort of, honestly, truthfully, so gently that it's so ironic of how vicious this disease is when it came to me so gently. It didn't come to me with this whirlwind of chaos. It came to me in slow drips, like a friend. And it only affirmed it when I took a couple and felt all over again. If people who aren't alcoholic could experience that, I don't know. I know I experienced that, and I experienced it every time. So Joe, as I'm sitting there across from him in this cafe, he says, do you have a bodily allergy to alcohol, Mike? And this is, again, very succinct, very staccato story, but it's true. And I said, yeah, I got that. And he said, do you have this mind that lies to you? And I said, yeah, I have that. And he said, well, that's the good news. It sounds almost like you're alcoholic. The bad news is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have no solution for either one of those things. We cannot fix your body. If you got it, you got it. We are not doctors. And if you have a mind that lies to you, contrary to popular belief, not trying to offend anybody, we are not counselors, we are not therapists. It's not what we do. We are fellow travelers. Somebody used the word pilgrim this weekend. I'm not exactly who that was. But I think that's really good. Right? We're people who walk together. Right? We're people that walk together. And Joe said, the only thing we work on is the third part of this disease, and that's called the broken soul. And I went, wow. And I didn't like hearing that term, but somehow, in some way, when he said that to me, it fit. That sort of described that ache that was wrong with me long before I ever took a drink, that alcohol always made me feel better about. Like it was the itch I couldn't scratch. It was a thing that no matter how much I could get you to think something positive of me, it never went away. No matter how much I could con you into thinking something about me, that itch never went away. Joe said, that's the only thing we work on in AA. I was blown away by that. He said, do you have a bodily allergy to alcohol? Yeah. Do you have a mind that lies to you? Yeah. He said, do you have a broken soul? And I said, yeah. He said, we're done with step one. Let's move on to step two. Tell me about God. I thought, well, that was awfully quick, right? He said, no, we're moving. I said, okay. I said, he must be big and he must be nice. He said, well, that's pretty good theology. Where'd you come up with that? And I said, well, if you go outside, you can just look around, and if he made all this, he must be bigger than everything he made. And truthfully, this was my thinking at 24. He said, that's pretty good. Why do you think he's nice? And I said, I don't know, but I just think he's giving me a second chance. I just feel like he's giving me a second chance, so he must be nice. He said, good. Step two's done. Let's move on. And we went into this room at this place called Southside Alcoholics Anonymous in Sioux Falls, and we got on our knees and we said the third step prayer together. And we got off those knees, he handed me a piece of paper and a pen. He said, write down your resentments, your fears, and your sex conduct. And we went through that, and we went through the prayers that book talks about as well. And we went through that whole thing about how we try to create a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life, pages 68 through 71. He pointed me to a priest. He said, you're Catholic, or sort of. Why don't you go over there and talk to a priest, right? And so I did, and I was with that very amazing guy for 6 hours. We came back, and we said 6 and 7 step prayer, and we crash-landed 8 and 9 within weeks, not months, weeks. And I'm not saying that's the right way to do it. I'm saying that's the way he told me to do it. And that's what we did. So I transferred all those names on that 4-step down into an 8-step. And he said, just start praying for the willingness to make amends to these people. And I said, you don't understand really who these people are. Like, we can't. He said, we're not at 9 yet. We're at 8. And I got to tell you, when it comes to the amends process, I think we often postpone the actual working of 9 because we haven't actually done 8. Right? 8 is about a list and praying for something that we don't have, or at least that I didn't have. And that's the willingness to actually do 9. It's not just a list. It's asking God, like we do in 6 and 7, to change my heart in such a way that I'll at least do step 9. All right? So I did that as best I could, and I started and start praying. And I remember he said, start going to step 9 meetings. So I started going to step 9 meetings. I heard all these really cool stories. There was one gal, she talked about how she was in the mall and how she had seen a girl from, like, I don't know, 3rd or 4th grade. And her friend, she had really hurt, and so she saw this gal, and she thought, wow, this is divinely inspired, and I'm going to go find this gal again in the mall, and I'm going to talk to her. And she did. She ran her down and hunted her down and just told this elaborately amazing story. And so I decided that that's probably how I was going to do this, is I was going to let God ordain this, and he was just going to put people from the south side of Chicago into the mall in Sioux Falls when I was supposed to make amends to them. And that would, you know, somehow our paths would cross and divinely this would all work out. Joe had a very different idea of how I was supposed to do that. So he gave me a couple of weeks to pray about it, and he would ask me, and I would start going to these 9 meetings, and he said, okay, how are we going to do this? I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, I got an idea. Friday when you're off work, I want you to get in your car, and I want you to drive the 9 hours to Chicago. And on Saturday and on Sunday morning, I want you to make amends to as many people as you possibly can. And then I want you to get back in your car somewhere around noon on Sunday and drive back to Sioux Falls because you have to be at work on time Monday. And I did that for months. Months. And I got to tell you, the first few drives were horrible. They were horrible. And truthfully, as I'm driving, I'm listening to things like Joe and Charlie, many of the people in the front row here in the second row as I've listened to as well as I'm driving back and forth. My heroes. And I'm listening to them, and they're telling me stories about how this is going to be great. And I got to tell you, I didn't buy it for a second. I didn't buy it for a second. Because I don't know about you, but like this weekend, what we have heard, I think, are honest hearts from this podium. We've heard honesty from this podium. And somehow, I know that I had a problem with honesty, and I probably still do at some level. But in those days, my ears, like you guys would say the truth, and my ears would translate it into lies, right? So when you were talking about your honest approach to step 9, I would hear that it was always going to be great. And again, I knew that didn't fit in. And when I go back and listen to those same talks again, that's not at all what you said. It's not at all what you said. What you said is it might be hard, but it'll be worth it. What you said is it might be difficult, but the promises come true even when we take the action in spite of how we feel the outcome may take place. I didn't hear you say that when I first listened to it. And so I'm comparing what I think you're saying to me to my fears of actually doing this stuff, and I'm rebelling against it all the way through. But I'm making these trips back home. And of course, the first one is to Mom. Mom was pretty easy, right? Because Mom is a Catholic mom. She's Irish Catholic mom, which is like, you know, Catholic on steroids kind of, right? And so she is morally obligated just to forgive me, you know? Like she has to, you know? So I made that like 7 times in a row. Like first 7 trips were all Mom, right? My sister and people that were close, so it was sort of easy. And but really, I got to tell you, as time went on, something began to happen, and I began to feel a freedom within me that I'd never really felt before. And truthfully, that I never felt after a fifth step. I mean, I had a great fifth step with this priest. It was wonderful. I felt clean. I felt washed, as we've heard this weekend. But the experience that I had with step 9 was very different. Very different. It began to sort of impact how I would act in the future or in the moment. And I didn't really understand why that was taking place. Prior to this, I tried to change. Anybody ever try to change, right? And I got to this spot where just doing the work somehow almost created a momentum where I didn't respond always the same way that I always had. It began to be a 10% change and then maybe a 15% change. But this process changed my life, step 8 and 9. It wasn't step 4 that changed my life. You know, it's interesting, in step 3 in our big book, it says we started upon a personal house cleaning, right? Personal house cleaning. And I don't know where I got this from, but I thought it said personal inventory. I thought personal inventory was personal house cleaning. I can tell you, I'm a married man. On Saturdays, we generally do chores. And if I made a list of all the chores that needed to be done and handed it to my wife and said, see, hon, we've cleaned the house, she would have a very different opinion of that. Making a list of what needs to be clean doesn't mean it's clean. Sharing the list with someone we care about or sharing the list for exposure doesn't mean it's clean. The debts I carried, the wrongs I said, the selfish sexual behavior that I had in my life was not clean until I went to those people and made that clean. I didn't file federal income tax for 4 years prior to joining Alcoholics Anonymous. Whoops. I mean, that can happen to anybody, really. I mean, it's not like those tax deadlines come around the same day every year or something. I mean, anybody can overlook that, you know. Illinois, same thing. I found an accountant in the program who helped me. And he wrote the state of Illinois and he got all the forms. We sat down and we did all the things. And for 3.5 years, I sent checks every single month to the IRS. And there were only 2 checks I wanted to send. The first one and the last one. There was a reason every single time for those checks not to be sent every single other month. The first one because I wanted to brag to Joe that I was doing it, right? And then the last one where I wanted to brag that I did it, right? But every single check in between there, there was a reason why I tried. I have rent due. I have this going on. I got to do that. You know, what am I supposed to do? Like, I mean, gosh, I can't. I mean, what, am I never going to live again? I mean, these are the kinds of things that would haunt me still. I had to just keep going, just keep taking the action. My mom was, a gentleman asked me just not moments ago what the hardest amends I had to make was. And the real one was to my mom. So yeah, I went in and I said I was sorry. But Joe and I continued to talk about that. And he said something to me. He said, Mike, you think that you have a bad mom. You think you had a bad mom when you were growing up. He said, the truth is she had a bad son. And that's very different. And he said, until you raise your awareness of what it means to be a son, that's never going to fit together. Because you want her to conform to what you think a good mom will do based on what your selfish needs are calling her to behave like. The real thing is, Mike, you have to learn how to become a son. And so he said, I want you to do something. Every weekend, I want you to call your mom. And I want you to ask her two questions. And the first question is, hey, mom, how was your week? And the second question is, wow, that sounds interesting. Could you tell me more about that? And I did that until she passed away. But I started this process. And he's like, look, early in this process, right, it's going to be very difficult. Like, she's going to push back on this because you're the guy that used to break into her front room window and steal money out of her purse. Right? And just because you've been sober for a few months doesn't mean, like, all that's gone. Right? She's not going to trust you. How many times have you tried this before? Right? Oh, you're sober again for another 8 days. Well, great, Mike. That's wonderful. Right? She needs time. Just keep calling. And he was right. The first few calls were like, hey, Ma, how was your week?
Fine.
Wow, that sounds interesting. Could you tell me more about that?
No.
Talk to you next week. Love you. Yeah. But honestly, over the series of months that those calls kept going out to her, a really strange thing happened. Her answers got a lot longer. And she began to tell me about her life. Well, you know, Roberta picked me up and went to Mass on Sunday, and then we went to breakfast. Kitty across the street drove me to work. You know, the dog's sick. I took the dog to the vet. You know, things that were not, I mean, like boring stuff, right? I mean, it's weird, though, because a few months after that, I actually began to care about the answers. And they mattered, and the whole conversation changed. And then it was, how was work this week, Mom? Did Kitty take you every day again? Right? How's the dog doing? I have no idea why, but before I knew it, before my eyes, through these actions, I became a son. And at 5 years sober, my sister, who is awesome, my sister next to my wife is probably my best friend on the planet. My sister's tremendous. She had all the stuff ready for my mom, like all the paperwork, you know, the will and all this, got all the stuff lined up, right? I'm the guy that's going to do it. My sister's the one who actually gets it done, if you like that. So she got all the paperwork there and put it in front of my mom for my mom to sign, and my mom won't sign it. And it sits there for a week or two. And Patty says, why aren't you going to do that? Why aren't you going to sign this paper? You know, you asked me to get it all done. She said, I'm going to wait for my son to come home. I'm not making any family decisions without my son. That may not seem like a big deal to you, but that's an enormous deal to me. It's an enormous deal to me because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my mom would not hug me and I would not hug her. We barely talked to each other. She could say hello to me and I knew what she meant. When she would say, hi, hon, how are you? I knew what she meant is I am so disappointed in you. You're ridiculous, and I know it. So I had to scream back at her at her hello. My wick was so short. She couldn't say anything to me without me unloading on her. Not at all. Just couldn't happen. Just couldn't happen. I said to Joe, I said, I don't know. This is not working early in this process. And he said, are you going home for Christmas? I said, yeah. He said, well, do me a favor. Hug your mom when you get there and when you leave. And I go, my mom and I don't really hug. And he goes, I'm not asking your mother to hug you. I'm asking you to hug your mother. And so I did it, and she was just paralyzed, man. I mean, she just did this. She didn't know what to do. And it just odd, just hit me odd. He said, well, do it again at St. Patrick's Day when you go home, and do it again when you go home for 4th of July, and just keep doing it. And I can bring you to the spot in my house that I grew up in, and it's a tea hallway right outside the kitchen. And I didn't even know I needed this. But at that tea, I can bring you to the spot where my mom's hands came up behind my back and she squeezed me for the first time in years. And she said, I'm so glad you're here. I haven't had a hug since the last time you were here. And it just broke my heart. Before my eyes, I became a son. I wasn't looking for that. I was looking to not drink. And if I would have stayed with not drinking and meeting attendance, my mom would have missed hugs from her son. And her son would have never become the son. It was fast forward now a number of years, and my mom is going in the hospital. They're doing some just exploratory stuff, and we do that. And she's at the hospital, and I said, I'm going to come home. I told my wife I'm going to go home for this. And we go there, and sure enough, she's got cancer. We didn't know she had cancer. And we go through this whole process of what she's going to do and what she's not going to do, whether she's going to fight it, not fight it. My mom was just an amazing person. She prayed all the time. My mom prayed me into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not smart enough to be here. I fully believe that my mom prayed me here. And so she went into hospice, and so I would go home every weekend, and I would spend that time with her. And we'd be by her bed, and we'd talk, and she just had a great, great sense of humor. It was my 40th birthday while I was there one time. This is my mom. This is exactly how my mom was. I said, Mom, do you know what today is? It's my 40th birthday. Mom, you know what today is? She's like, yes. And I go, it's the 40th anniversary of the happiest day of your life, right? And my mom, the only way just a great Irish mother could do it, she's looking at me. I come in this way, and she looks at me, and she goes, oh, shit. And puts her head out of it. My mom was great. And it was my wife and I, and my sister, and a couple of close friends, and my mom had a great devotion to Our Lady of Mount Carmel, and in the middle of a rosary, smack dab in it before we started rosary, Hail Mary 6 in the middle of it. She passed away, took her last breath. And the coolest part of that is she went clean. She went free. There was no malice between us anymore. Right? We had 15 years of just talking every week and loving each other. Right? About a month before she died, maybe two, I remember thinking as I'm traveling in Indianapolis one time for work, I remember thinking, I bet your mom, maybe your mom's got something. She's bedridden. She can't go out, right? There's nothing she can do. Maybe there's something in her life that she needs cleaned up. So I call her on the phone while I'm traveling, and I said, Mom, we got this thing in Alcoholics Anonymous called Step 8 and 9. Remember we did that? Yeah, I remember that. I said, look, you're getting home to go to the Lord. We all know that. No secrets, right? You're in hospice. There's no secrets. And if there's anything that you need to make right, so why don't you write it down, and I'll go try to make it right for you. And my mom says, no, I'm okay. It's okay. Just if something changes, let me know. She calls me back 2 or 3 days later, and she said, the next time you're in, there's a couple people I'd like you to go see. 2 months before my mom died, I got to drive around the city of Chicago looking for two people that my mom wanted to make something right for, that you guys taught me how to do, because Bill and Bob wrote a book, right? And Silkworth explained that allergy and went on and talked about that inability to differentiate true things from the false, and more about alcoholism, lays it out. And then that great third step where it says, I'm not really here to just be sober. I'm here to be God's child and God's agent. And he's supposed to be the father, the principal, and the director. Move right into that third step. And if I'd have just settled for not drinking, I wouldn't have had any of that. And I go into my mom's hospice room, and she's got two names written on a little corner of a magazine. Just two names. My eighth step was like a roll of Bounty paper towel that you just kept going, right? My mom had two names, right? And I found both of those people. And I had the privilege and the honor of going in and saying, Anne Marie Donnelly wants to make this right. And I tell you, when I found the first person, I couldn't believe it. When I found the second person, I couldn't believe it. And I'm driving back to the hospice, and I'm like elevated. You know, I'm just not even touching the ground. I just can't believe that this is my life, that this is the life you gave me. Until I walk in and hand that piece of paper with those names crossed off and look at my mom's eyes. And it's the same eyes that we get when we sponsor people. And there's that one amend they're never going to make. That one thing they're never going to get right. That thing that's so unfair. And they make it. And you can see the freedom just flood across her. And it was so wonderful. It was so wonderful. I heard a lot of women when I was out there, or at least in my mind, right? So I'm serious. It was a lot, okay? It was a lot. And sorry. But this, for me at least, is an area that I don't hear talked about very much, right? Bill asked us to look at three things on our four-step, our resentments, our fears, and our sex conduct, and we talk a boatload about resentments. And holy smokes, can we go for hours on fear? When we talk about selfish behavior in the sexual arena, it's much more modest. And I understand. It's okay. I'm just when I did my four-step, Joe was pretty clear that it didn't say a sexual intercourse inventory. It said a sex conduct inventory. That's how I kind of wandered the planet as a man. And underneath that was probably some behaviors that would fall under the sexual activity category. Right? He said, "What's sex?" And I'm like, "Joe, if you don't know by now, like, come on." He said, No. What's sex? He said, "When you fill out a job application and it says sex, you don't say please right after the interview, do you?" I mean, depending on the salary and the benefits package, maybe. And that's not what you write in there. So I had to go find people that I had hurt. And I had to go look them in the eye and say, "You know, that was selfish of me." And some people may, you know, consensual is not listed in the big book. It's selfishness that's listed in the big book. And in my case, sometimes it was mutually selfish, right? But it's my side of the street. I don't get permission to retain my side of the street if it was mutually selfish. I don't think. But I got to tell you, nothing changed my life more as it relates to my marriage, my relationship with my mom, my relationship with my sister, and future women that I've met in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, is making amends for the people I hurt when I was outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? And for all I know, there's somebody in here who may have been hurt by a selfish guy like me. And if that's the case, on behalf of selfish men, I'm sorry. These women, I got very different responses from. Very different responses. Some were, you know, what are you talking about? And some you could see that I really hurt them. And what's odd about that is I began to sort of learn some things through this process of the amends. Here, with money, with my family. And one of the things that I learned was that my behavior matters. That I really have the capacity to hurt and to scald someone, even when it doesn't seemingly matter. Maybe it's a quick word, maybe it's a smart aleck comment, or maybe it's something pretty bad, pretty selfish. But I have the capacity to harm people. In that sense, like, I must have the capacity to really help them or bless them if I treat them right. You know, I understand this phrase, like, you're not that important. And I get it, it's true, I'm not that important. Unless you're married to me, then I'm pretty important. And it matters what my wife thinks of herself, and it matters the role I play in how she thinks about herself. I'm not that important unless you're my son, and what I model in my home and how I model that women should be treated in my home and the words I say there. Then maybe I'm important. All that came together in this step. And if I'd have settled for only not drinking, I would have missed it all, but so would have Marsh. And so would have Cody and Kyle, who are my stepsons, who are like the greatest kids in the world. They're just great. They're just great. My dad passed when I was 6. And my dad was an extraordinarily honorable man. He served multiple tours of duty in Korea. He came back. He was a police officer. And
He was a man of honor, as I said, and I was not. I was a man of dishonor. And I hated being that guy, but you know, the truth is I didn't know how else to be. And I didn't know how to make amends for that. Because the one thing I remember my mom saying to me all the time when I was about 13 or 14 years old and started to get really wild, she said, never dishonor your father's name. And I did a lot more than that. I didn't know how to do that. And Joe said, write a letter and go to your dad's grave and read it to your dad. And I did that. Wrote a 3-page letter to my dad, and I walked into St. Mary's Cemetery in 87th and Pulaski in Chicago, and I read that to my dad. And I told him I was sorry for dishonoring his name and the things he tried to teach me, even as a little boy, that I felt dirty about doing. Told him I was sorry for that. And if somehow in this economy of heaven or how all this works, if he could help me, I'd try not to do it anymore. And the sky didn't open, and I didn't see a vision. But I'm telling you, I walked away from that grave connected to him in some way that I can't really explain. There's no word for that. And if I'd have settled for sobriety alone, I would have missed that too. I would have missed that too. When I was drinking, with some things I did that I wasn't too proud of, and one of them was this priest. I'd won this award in college before I drank my way out, by the way. And he was a very gracious man to me. His name was Father Phil. And so I'm at this dance, and I'm drunk, and I just, I don't know. I didn't treat him very well, you see, because a year before that, the night the Bears won the Super Bowl, and I think next to the signing of the Declaration of Independence, probably the greatest day in the history of U.S. history. And I was coming back from this bar, and I was really intoxicated. I mean, I was hammered, and I was sort of dating this gal, and I just, I don't know how you guys operate, but I would occasionally get this wave of guilt, this enormous wave of guilt that was just flowing over me. And I said, I got to go to confession. And she's like, it's like 2:00 in the morning. And I go, no, I got to go now. Right? I got to go now. So on this rectory door, and this priest comes down, and he's like, what's going on? I said, Father, I got to go to confession. And he's like, we do that on Wednesdays. I go, I know, but I got to go now. And this guy says, meet me in the church. So he comes down, he unlocks the door, and I sit in this church. And I give him my confession with the girlfriend sitting next to me. I wouldn't recommend that. We didn't date very long after the confession. Not sure why, really. A few guesses, but I had nothing concrete. And so the next Sunday, of course, my friends go off to Mass. I don't. I got other things to do, right? And they come back and they're talking about the homily that the priest gave that night. And he mentioned this one student that he had a connection with and this experience that the student had. Now, there were 75 kids on the campus, and he was president or in charge of all the campus ministry, and yet I knew he was talking about me, right? Knew it. So I hated that man. And I don't know if you're a guy in the room, maybe you'll get this, but every time I'd see him in the hall, I would walk at him, right, to see. Anybody ever play like what buck has the biggest antlers, right? So I'd play this. I would walk right at him so he would move, so he'd have to get out of my way. And I would belittle him, and I would say things to him in the hall, and he'd say hi to me, and I'd shoot him a look and just walk past him. And I remember you have to sort of time that move, right? It's like your shoulder needs to be right at their shoulder, so they have to sort of move out of the way, right? So I drank my way out of school, and I'm at this event, and it's actually one of the year before, and I had to go back to give it to the next person, and Father Phil is there. And he says, hey, Mike, haven't seen you in a while. How's it going? And they were selling baby buds, which were like 3 for $5, these little glass bottles of Budweiser. And we're sitting at the end of the bar, me and 3 or 4 or 5 of my friends. And I go, good, Father, how are you? He says, good. I said, I don't see you out there dancing, Father. You know, it's a dance, and I don't really see you doing anything. Why don't you? Probably been a long time since you've been with a woman. Why don't you go out there and dance a little bit?
And he said, don't do that to me. And I go, you probably forgot how to ask. No problem. And I whistled a young gal over. She had some red hair, and she was walking by. And I said, you know, it's been a long time since Father's been with a woman. Why don't you go out there and dance with him? And she kind of gave me one of those. And he said, Mike, don't do that. And I said, is it red hair, Father? You don't like redheads? I totally understand. No problem. Another gal was coming by. She happened to be a brunette. I said, here's a brunette. Why don't you take Father out on the dance floor and go dance with him? It's been a long, long time since he's been with a woman. And he just looked at me. He said, what are you doing? And this rage just came in me. And I reached over to the outside side of the bar with all those empty Baby Bud bottles, and I threw them at this priest's feet. And I poked him in the chest, and I said, Father, when I tell you to dance, I mean dance. And I began to throw these bottles at this priest's feet, who had given me his time at 2:30 in the morning or whatever the heck time it was, to be an example of what God's grace is all about. And that's how I treated him. I humiliated him in front of his staff, in front of the other students. I don't know how you make that right. I have no idea how you make that right. And yet Father Phil was on my A step. So I talked to Joe about it, and we talked and talked and talked, and I couldn't find him. I went to the university. He had transferred to another school, St. Xavier. Went to St. Xavier, wasn't there. Tried to track him around a little bit. I finally found the guy living in New Lenox, Illinois. And I called him up. I'm in Sioux Falls. I talked to Joe. I said, should I wait till I go back? He said, no, you've looked long enough. Just make the call. So I made the call. And I said, Father Phil, this is Mike Donnelly. Maybe you remember me. He goes, yeah, I think I remember you. Yeah. And I said, look, I don't even know how to make this right. I mean, I don't even know how to do this, right? I just feel awful because I humiliated you. You were nothing but an agent of God being graceful to me and gracious to me, and I was a jerk. And I don't know how to make that right. And he paused and he asked me what I was doing with my life. I said I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was trying to fix my life so I don't drink again, get this relationship with God so God can keep me sober and I can worry about God's kids and God can worry about me. He said he thought that was pretty cool. And I said, what can I do to make this right, Father? And he thought it was silence on the phone for a little bit. Then he came back and he said this. I mean, right? This is not what I would say. But when we're involved in these actions, and these actions bring us to places that, look, our drinking brought us to places we could have never imagined. Right? That's just true. But these actions bring us to places we could never dream of. Could never dream of. He says to me, if you can ever tell this story to encourage someone to do what you're doing, tell it. And how you can make this right to me is that night when you go home and go to bed and you thank God for your day of sobriety, he said, would you pray for me and my family? I said, yeah. So tonight when I hit my knees and I thank God for another day of sobriety, I'm going to pray for Father Phil's family again. And the experiences that I've had with 8 and 9... for me, were revolutionary. They should have not taken place. They should have not taken place. And it leads me to some of these conclusions. And the first conclusion is most of the statements in my head that end with a period were wrong. And what steps 8 and 9 do is they allow it to become a comma. And then I can finish writing the story. Right? So you're a jackass. You threw bottles at a priest. Period. And that's what I carried with me. Because it was true. What 8 and 9 did is they said, you're a jerk, you threw bottles at a priest, comma. But you made it as right as you could. You stole from people, you broke into your mom's house, period. No, comma. But you went back to her, you looked her in the eye, and you apologized, and you paid it back. Doesn't make it okay. Those are still wrongs, right? These are women that you hurt, period. Look at who you are, period. Look at what a scumbag you are. Look at the things you did. Look at the terrible... this rot that's in our heads can eat us alive. And worse, can lead us back to that slow death that drinking almost always brings. Because it's not a fast death, it's a slow death. I don't want periods anymore, I want commas. I'm going to make my mistakes, man. Who here isn't? I just don't want periods at the end of those mistakes. I want commas. I want to be the guy that's not. Look, I would love to be perfect, but that's just not going to happen. That's just not going to happen. And so I'm flawed, I'm broken, I'm going to make a ton of mistakes. But if I can utilize the principles in step 8 and 9, which I'm sure we're going to hear about wonderfully tomorrow in 10 and 11, if I can use those in my moment with God, I can turn those periods into commas and I can finish writing the story with an amend instead of just a wrong, just a defect. I want to close with two stories, if you don't mind. First one is what I think Alcoholics Anonymous is. And it reminds me of the story that I have after my dad passed away. My mom had us in the Toys R Us right around Thanksgiving, just after Thanksgiving. And I don't know if anybody remembers Lost in Space. Anybody remember that show, right? So there was this end display in this cabinet where these dolls, right? And they were the robot dolls. And I remember always wanting to be Will Robinson. And I said to my mom, please buy one. And she lied to me and said if I was a good boy, Santa would bring one. And I was a bad boy, but Santa brought one anyways. And I opened it up and I was amazed at it. I mean, I played with this thing like you wouldn't believe. Up and down the stairs was up and down this crater and the moon, right? The couch was one planet. The lazy boy chair was another planet. And I had a blast with it. And then somewhere around the 4th, 5th, 6th of January, something like that, my mom runs off to Woolworths, buys 4 or 6 D batteries, and she shoves them in the butt end of this thing, and it lights up like the 4th of July. And I thought I had fun playing with this thing before the batteries were in it. Holy smokes, right? Little cylinder head, all lights flashing everywhere. The deal is that robot had all the potential to be what it was after it got power, before it had the power. And I submit to you that that's me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to you, batteries not included. I had no power to live the life that my heart always longed that I should be living and failed at it all the time. I couldn't get it together, even a little. I couldn't move in the direction of life the way I wanted it to be. And ultimately, and it's already been said multiple times this weekend, that's all about love. I couldn't love you. I was too afraid. I don't know why I was too afraid. I just was. So it became easy to take from you instead of give to you. What this program has taught me is that if I can live right here, just if I can live right here with God, that He fills me in spite of my weakness. And when He fills me, I have enough to give. I don't have to worry about losing. Losing isn't even part of the equation. And I was so afraid that I would lose before. I was so afraid that someone would take something from me. I was so afraid that I wasn't enough. I had to pretend to be something I wasn't. This program turns that voice down in my head when I'm working it. Turns it down in my head so that I can be present to Him and receive from Him and then have an abundance to give back to you. And that's when my life clicks. Last story I'm going to share is this an amends story. And I had stolen from a customer. His name was Joe, too. And I lied to him. There was this contract, right? And see, I don't know about you guys, but in sales contests, like, I don't like winning. I have to win. I have to win. Doesn't matter what it is, I have to win, right? Sports, doesn't matter, right? Got to win, or I'm not playing, right? Not playing. So I'm in this deal, and I'm doing the best I can in the sales contest, and I'm close. I can smell it. Blood in the water, chum, right? I can smell it. So I go to this guy, and I sell him this product I was selling at the time, and I added in some things he didn't need to buy, and I told him he needed to. It was about $750 difference, not a big thing, but still, for me at 24 years old, that was a big deal. I looked him right in the eye, and I lied to him. Comes time for renewal, and I go to Joe, and I said, look, here's what I did to this guy, and I don't know what to do about it. And he said, well, first thing you got to do is you got to go to your boss and tell your boss what you did because you misrepresented your company's contracts. You lied to them. So go to them first, and then whatever they say to do, we'll talk after that. And so I did that, and my boss told me, well, it's renewal time. Can't you just tell them that those parts aren't in the contract anymore?
And I went, well, yeah, I can, but no, I can't. Right?
And my boss says to me, well, if this person brings up any kind of problem with you, I'm just going to say that I didn't know. And I went, okay, guess I'm on my own, sort of, right? So I called Joe back. Here's the deal. He said, well, you can't do that, so just pay the guy back. I said, well, I don't have it. He said, well, what do you have? I said, $250. He said, all right, give him that. So I called this guy up, Joe, and I said, hey, Joe, you're my customer. I want to meet with you. I want to talk to you a little bit. He said, okay. And we met. And I go into his office. And he said, you sound a little distraught, man. What's going on? I said, well, here's the deal. I stole from you, right? Last year at contract time, I put in all these adders so I could win this contest, so I could get more money, and I lied. I stole from you. And I don't have the money to pay you back. I don't have the $750. But I do have a check for $250. And if you'll take that in 6 weeks, I get another commission check, and I'll come back with the $500 more, and we'll be square. And he asked me the oddest thing. He said, why are you here? And I was like, well, I stole $750 from you, and you hear me, you know? He said, no, I got that. Why are you doing this? Why are you here? Why are you here doing this? And I started to cry in this guy's office. And I said, I'm a mess. And I don't want to be a mess anymore. I'm a drunk. And I don't want to be a drunk anymore. He said, can I tell you a story? And I was like, sure. Please. He said, when I was a kid, I used to pick peas with my brother, and we'd go down to this place called Cherry Creek Farms, and we had these baskets, and we'd pick peas, and you almost became unconscious. Like, you just start movement going, and you just wouldn't even pay attention to it, and all of a sudden, it just became second nature, and you just do it. And if you filled the basket up to this line, you got a quarter. He said, there were two bells that rang. The first bell that rang was to let you know that you had 15 minutes left to pick, and the second bell that rang meant the pickup truck is leaving and it's a long walk back to the farmhouse, so you better be in the pickup truck. He said, so one day I'm picking, Mike, and I'm just going, and I'm not even thinking like normal. It becomes unconscious, and I'm just doing my thing. He said, and all along the horizon, there was some train tracks, and there was a little gully, and I saw a guy jump off the train, which hobos would do back then, and kind of get some shelter underneath there. He said, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this guy, he's got a big 10-gallon cowboy hat, and he's putting peas in his cowboy hat, and it's in my row. He's taking my peas. He said, and I'm just beside myself, and I can't focus. No matter what I do, I can't focus. And he said, and I get off rhythm, and then I hear the bell ring, and I look down, and I'm not going to make my quarter for this basket because I lost my rhythm. Now I'm angry at the guy. He's not only taken my peas, but he's broken my rhythm, and I'm not going to get my quarter. So before that second bell rang, I started to turn around and walk down my row, waiting for the pickup truck to take us back to the farmhouse. And I get a few steps down and I hear, hey, kid. Joe says he turns around, and it was, sure enough, it was this hobo. And he had this hat, and it was filled up with these peas. And he walks over to him and he dumps the hat full of peas into Joe's basket and fills it up to his line. He's going to get his quarter. He said, Mike, this hobo pokes me in the chest. And he says, remember that, kid. Somebody gave you a hat full of peas one day, and you didn't ask for it, and you got one anyway. And someday somebody's going to come knocking on your door, Mike, or Joe, and they're going to need a hat full of peas, and you better give them one because somebody gave you one once. And he says, you know what I mean, Mike? And I was like, no. I don't know. The hell are peas? I don't. He said, I don't want your checks, Mike. He said, ready for this? The honesty in your eye is payment enough. What? He said, you can drop checks off here all you want. I'll never cash them. Don't care. Don't want your money. Don't care. He said, as a matter of fact, I don't know what you do for work, but I know what you do for work, but if you ever lose this job or something and you need another job, he said, I want you to come see me. We could use an honest guy like you in this business. I'm the thief, right? And he said, if you don't want to work in this business, that's perfectly okay. Perfectly okay. He said, but if you ever need a letter of recommendation, he said, you call me and I'll write you one. I'll have my secretary write it up, I'll sign it, and you can just pick it up at the front door. You see, none of the amends I ever made went the way I believed in my head they would go. That's not supposed to happen that way. He's supposed to yell at me, take my $250 for sure, yell at me, call my boss, get me fired, right? And now I got another financial conflict because I get that commission check coming in that I promised him $500 for and I wouldn't be able to pay my bills after I did that. See, that's what I knew was going to happen. There's beauty in being wrong, right? I have a really good friend in the program. His name is Mark. And Mark always says, look, the grace of God is certainly found in the things that happen, but man, they are found in the things that don't. And he's right. So Joe says one more thing. He stands up and he comes around the desk and he does this. And I'm a big dude and he was as big as me. And I was like, what? He said, give me a hug. I stand up and I hug this guy and there's only two thoughts going through my head. I'm like, I cannot believe this is happening. That was the first thought. And the second one was, no matter what you do, do not get snot on his tie. He's just, right? I mean, he's giving you the once over on 750, like, don't burn this bridge, right? But he said something to me and he pulled me back on my shoulders and he said, I'm giving you a hat full of peas, Mike. And you didn't ask for one. And you certainly don't deserve one, but someday somebody's going to come knocking on your door and they're going to need a hat full of peas, bud. And you better give them one because somebody gave you one once. Guys, I just want to say to you that I think that this is the hat full of peas. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was looking to not drink. And through this process of steps 1 through 9, I was able to become a son. I was able to pay my debts. $40,000 in credit card debt. On stupid stuff like pizza, and there wasn't even a big screen TV in that 40 grand. Like, there was nothing of any value. Slowly but surely. And with every slowly but surely, a new world came into view. And I'm not going to get into tomorrow's steps, but tomorrow's steps helped me stay in that new world. But I got to see one first. And when I came, the only thing I could see is a life that would be miserable without booze. And what you gave me is a life that's glorious with God. Thank you for that world. God bless you all.